Thanks, but I just got this. I motioned to my 660 XS. I'm not in the market. Hubbard smiled. It's funny, because we've begun discussions with Sebring Warner about a merger. I read that in the Post this morning, Dad said. That story was only about 60% inaccurate, Hubbard said. Aha, I said. Then I looked over at Schwartz.
What?
He said. That's why you're using an Ajax 370, I said. Market research. Schwartz looked at me blankly. Very perceptive, Hubbard said. Yes, Sam's been trying out some of the models, along with some other folks on my staff. There's something to be said for hands-on experience, as it were. Is this related to Abrams Kettering? Dad asked. The merger talks. Somewhat, Hubbard said. The government subsidy for threeps dries up at the end of the year, so right now we're selling every threep we can put out there. But when January comes around, everything's going to contract. Merging's a hedge against that. But I'm also interested in their R&D program, which is doing some interesting things. He turned to me. They're doing some groundbreaking work in taste right now. As in aesthetics or in, like, tasting things, I asked. Actually tasting things, Hubbard said. It's been the one sense that's really never been well developed in threeps because there's not a practical use for it. Threeps don't have to eat, but there's no reason why they couldn't. He pointed to my place setting, which was bare of food. Your being at the table right now would be more natural if you were eating and not just sitting there. To be fair, I am eating, I said, just in the other room. And through a tube, which I did not say because that might be a little dark for dinner conversation. And my seat cushion has an inductive charger, so my threep's eating too, so to speak. Even so, Hubbard said. Chris, one of the great goals that you and your family have tried to realize is the idea of making people see threeps as human. Despite your good work, there's still a ways to go with it. He motioned over to Carol Lamb, who seemed startled by the sudden attention. Our colleague's daughter has made that point for us just this evening. Being able to have a threep sit down to a meal and actually eat would continue that humanizing path. Maybe, I said. I have to tell you, I wonder where the food would go once I tasted it. There are better ways to humanize Haydens, Buchold said. Like giving them back their bodies. Hubbard turned his attention to Buchold. Ah, right, Jim Buchold, the one person at the table whose business isn't affected by Abrams Kettering. I don't think you can criticize Congress of keeping Hayden medical research levels at 100%, Buchold said. We're looking to solve the problem, not profit from it. That's noble of you, Hubbard said. Although I saw Loudon's last quarterly, you're profiting just fine. Buchold turned to me. Chris, let me ask you, he said. He pointed to my empty dinner plate. How would you rather taste your food? Through a threep or with your own tongue? Now it was Wisson's turn to shoot his husband a look, and rightly so. There was no way this discussion was not going to get awkward fast. But before I could answer, Buchold continued on. We've been working on research to unlock Hayden's sufferers, he said. Not just simulate eating, but to give Hayden's back the basic body integrity to do things like chew and swallow, to free their bodies and bring them back. Bring us back from what, exactly? Hubbard said. From a community of 5 million people in the U.S. and 40 million worldwide? From an emerging culture that interacts with but is independent of the physical world, with its own concerns, interests, and economy? You're aware that a large number of Haydens have no memory of the physical world at all, aren't you? Hubbard pointed at me. Chris here experienced lock-in at 2 years old. What do you remember from being 2, Jim? I glanced over to Dad, but he was engaged in a side discussion with Carol Lamb and my mother. He was going to be no help here. You're missing the point, Buchold said. What we're trying to offer is options. The ability to break free of the physical constraints Haydens live with daily. Do I look constrained to you? Hubbard said. Does Chris? I'm right here, guys, I said. Then tell me, do you feel constrained? Hubbard asked me. Not really, I admitted. But then, as you said, I don't have much basis for comparison. I do, Hubbard said. I was 25 when I was locked in. The things I've done since then are things any person could do, that any person would want to do.
You just have to borrow someone else's body to do them, Buchold said. Hubbard smiled, showing his teeth. I don't borrow someone else's body to pretend I don't have Hayden's, Jim, he said. I borrow someone else's body because otherwise there's a certain percentage of people who forget I'm a person.
All the more reason for a cure, Buchold said.
No, Hubbard said. Making people change because you can't deal with who they are isn't how it's supposed to be done. What needs to be done is for people to pull their heads out of their asses. You say cure, I hear you're not human enough.
Oh, come on, Buchold said. Don't get on that horse with me, Hubbard. No one's saying that, and you know it.
Do I? Hubbard said. Here's something to think about, Jim. Right now, neural networks and threeps and all the innovations that came out of the Hayden Research Initiative Act have been kept to the benefit of Haydens. So far, the FDA has only approved them for Haydens. But paraplegics and quadriplegics can benefit from threeps. So can other Americans with mobility issues. So can older Americans whose bodies are failing them in one way or another.
The FDA has kept threeps to Haydens victims because jamming a second brain into your head is inherently dangerous, Buchold said. You do it if you have no other choice.
But everyone else should still have that choice, Hubbard said. And now, finally, they're going to get access to these technologies, among every other thing it does. Abrams Kettering sets a pathway to getting these technologies out to more people. More Americans will be using these technologies in the future. Millions more. When they do, Jim, are you going to dismiss and belittle them, too?
I don't think you're hearing what I'm saying, Buchold said.
I'm hearing it just fine, Hubbard said. I want you to hear that what I hear sounds like bigotry.
Jesus, Buchold said. Now you sound like that goddamn Cassandra Bell woman.
Oh, man, I said.
What? Buchold said, turning to me.
I said.
Chris doesn't want to tell you that my integrator for the evening is Nicholas Bell, Cassandra Bell's older brother, Hubbard said. I, on the other hand, don't have a problem letting you know that.
Buchold stared at Hubbard silently for a moment. Then,
you have got to be fucking Jim, Wisson said, interrupting.
Everything all right? Dad asked. His attention had finally returned to our end of the table.
Everything's fine, Dad, I said.
But I think Jim has a couple of questions that might be best asked to you directly. If Carol doesn't mind swapping seats with him for a bit, that would be lovely.
Of course not, Lamb said.
Excellent, I said, and looked over to Buchold, hoping he would take the hint, or at least be grateful to me for some FaceTime with Dad. He nodded curtly, stood up, and swapped seats. Hubbard leaned in.
Nice save, he said, very quietly.
I nodded and then rubbed my jaw. The pain was coming back. I was pretty sure it wasn't because of my molar. My internal phone went up. I answered it with my inside voice.
Yeah, I said.
Shane?
Van said.
How far are you from Leesburg right now?
About 10 miles, I said. Why?
You've heard of Loudon Pharma?
In fact, I'm having dinner with its CEO and his husband, I said. Why?
It just blew up, Van said.
What? I looked over at Buchold, who was speaking close in and animatedly with my dad.
It just blew up, Van repeated. And it looks like a Hayden was involved.
You're joking. I wish I was, because then I'd be getting laid instead of heading your direction, Van said. Get out there now. Start mapping the place and getting data. I'll be there in about 40 minutes.
What do I tell Jim Buchold? I asked.
He the CEO?
Yeah, I said. Then I noticed Buchold reaching into his suit pocket for his phone.
Hold on. I think he may be finding out.
Buchold leapt up and ran out of the room, phone still up to his ear. Rick Wisson watched him leave, confused.
Yep, I said. He knows.
Chapter 8. The Loudon Pharma campus consisted of two main buildings. One held the offices for the C-suite, middle management and support staff, local reps, and the company's lobbyists for D.C. and Richmond. The other contained the labs, which housed the scientists, the IT people, and their respective support staffs. The office building was a wreck. Every window on the east side of the structure was shattered and had fallen out of the walls. Most of the rest of the windows were in various stages of damage. Paperwork wafted out of holes, fluttering in the air before coming to rest in the shady boulevard that separated the two buildings from each other. The labs were mostly gone. Fire engines from every corner of Loudon County surrounded the rubble,
and firemen looked for something to put out. There was very little to put out. The explosion had collapsed the building on itself, smothering any incipient fire before it could catch. EMTs circled the collapsed building, using scanners to locate ARFID-equipped personnel badges the Loudoun Pharma staff used. There were 6 badges pinging, all for janitorial staff. The EMT deployed roach and snake bots to scurry through the wreckage toward the badges to see if they were still attached to anyone alive. They were not. "Here's what the security guard saw," I said to Van. We were in her car, and I was porting the images to her dash. She was sucking like a demon on one of her cigarettes. It might have been a side effect of sexual frustration, but now was not the moment to ask. I kept the door on my side open to vent the smoke. In the dash, we were treated to a guard post camera view of an SUV accelerating into the parking lot and then ramming through the gate, snapping it off as it drove through. "Back it up and pause it just before the snap," Van said. I did. She pointed. "License plate and face," she said. "Right," I said, neither of which matched the ARFID badge that pinged when the SUV rammed through, though. "Who does the badge belong to?" "Carl Baer," I said. "He's a geneticist, works in the lab. He's also a Hayden, which is why we were pinged." "That's not a threep driving the SUV," Van said. "So whoever this is stole Baer's ID, but why would they do that and then just ram the goddamn gate?" "They needed the ID to access the parking garage under the labs," I said. "Staff parking is in the garage, visitors parking outside." "And an SUV full of explosives is much more effective under the building than next to it. I imagine that's the thinking, yes." "So, if it's a stolen ID, do we need to be here?" Van asked. "Still?" I paused for a second, wondering why she would ask me that, then remembered it was still my first day with her, unbelievable as it was at this point. She was still testing me. "Yeah, we do," I said. "One, we need to check in on Baer to make sure the ID was stolen. 2, I pointed back to the image of the SUV about to ram the gate, there's the fact that this SUV is registered to Jay Kearney." "Am I supposed to know who Jay Kearney is?" "You might," I said. "He's an integrator. Or was." Van took a final suck on her cigarette and put it out on her window glass. "Show me a clean picture of Kearney," she said. I loaded his integrator license picture into the dash and placed it next to the image of the person driving the car. Van leaned in and peered. "What do you think?" I asked. "Could be. Could be," she said. She glanced up over the dash toward the collapsed building and the flashing lights of the cops, firemen, and EMTs. "Have they found him yet?" "I don't think they're looking for him," I said. "They're looking for the janitors. And anyway, if he was in the SUV when it went up, then he's a fine coat of ash all over that parking garage." "You share this with anyone yet?" "No one here is interested in talking to me," I said. "I'm Hayden Affairs, not terrorism." As I said this, the distant sound of a helicopter became loud and got louder. "That's probably terrorism right now," Van said. "They like to make an entrance." I motioned back at the image. "I got this from security the same time the Leesburg cops and the Loudoun sheriffs did, but I don't think they've looked at it yet." "All right," she said. She wiped the images off her screen. "Where are you parked?" "I'm not," I said. "I caught a ride with Jim Buchold, the CEO. He's over yelling at the Leesburg cops." "Good," Van said. She started her car. "Where are we going?" I closed the door on my side. "We're going to visit Carl Baer," Van said. "Pull up his address, please." "Do we need a warrant?" I asked as I did it. "I want to talk to him, not arrest him," Van said. "But you might see if you can get a warrant for Kearney's records. I want to know who he was integrating with. See if you can pull Nicholas Bell's records, too. 2 integrators, possibly tied up with murder in a single day, is a little much for me." Carl Baer's apartment was in a little gray apartment complex in Leesburg, next to a supermarket and an International House of Pancakes. He was in a bottom corner apartment, tucked underneath a stairwell. There was no response when we knocked. "He is Hayden," I pointed out. "If he's living here, he's got a threep," Van said. "If he's got a damn employee badge at Loudoun Pharma, then he's got a threep. He can answer the door." She knocked again. "I'll go around back and see if I can see in a window," I said after a minute. "Yeah, okay," Van said. "No, wait." She tried the doorknob. It turned all the way. "You really going to do this?" I asked, looking at the doorknob. The door was open, Van said. The door was closed, I said, just unlocked.
Are you recording?
Right now? No.
Van pushed the door open.
Look, it's open, she said.
You're just a beacon of safe constitutional practices, Van, I said, echoing her from earlier in the day.
She grinned. Come on, she said.
We found Carl Baer in his bedroom, a knife shoved into his brain. A threep was standing beside his cradle, knife handle in hand, flush with Bear's temple.
Holy shit, I said.
Go open the window blinds, Van said.
I did what she told me. If anyone asks, you came around the back, looked in and saw this, and that's when we entered the apartment.
I don't have a good feeling about this, I said.
What's to feel good about? Van asked. Are you recording yet?
No, I said. Start, she said.
I'm on.
Van went over to the light switch and flipped it on with her elbow.
Start mapping, she said.
She put on a pair of gloves as I did so.
After I was done mapping, she went over and picked up a tablet on the side table next to Bear's cradle and turned on the screen.
Shane, she said.
She turned the tablet around so I could see the screen.
Jay Kearney was on it.
Is it a video?
I asked.
Yeah, Van said, turning the screen back to her.
I walked over to her and she pressed play.
On the screen, Jay Kearney came to life. He was holding the tablet so that he and Carl Baer were both caught by the camera.
This is Carl Baer, Kearney said. I am speaking for myself, for my good friend Jay Kearney, with whom I am now integrated. For the past 8 years, I have worked at Loudon Pharma as a geneticist, as part of a team working to reverse the effects of Hayden syndrome. When I joined Loudon, I believed that what I was doing was right for Hayden's. None of us asked to be trapped within our bodies. I know I didn't. I was a teenager when I got sick, and all the things I loved to do were taken from me. Working to reverse the changes that Hayden's had brought into my life made sense to me. I looked forward to the chance to have that new life. But as I went on, I began to realize that Hayden's wasn't some life sentence. It was just another way to live. I began to see the beauty of the world we Haydens were creating, the millions of us, in our own spaces and in our own way. And I began listening to the words of Cassandra Bell, who said that people like me, people who were working to quote-unquote cure Haydens, were in fact killing the first new nation of humanity to come along in centuries. She's right. We are. I am. And it's time to put a stop to it now. It's not something I could have done by myself. Fortunately, my friend Jay believes as I do, and believes it enough to help me. Others, who will remain nameless, helped along the way to provide us with materials and planning. And now, all that needs to be done is to set it all into motion. Jay and I will do it together. And when his part is over, then I will come back here in order to join him on the next part of our journey together. I guess, if you're seeing this, you know how I did this. For my family and friends, I know that my actions, our actions, may not seem comprehensible. I know that there's a chance that a few innocent people will be harmed or even killed. I regret this and apologize to those who will lose loved ones tonight. But I ask them to understand that if I don't take these actions now, then what Loudon Pharma is doing will lead to the extinction of an entire people. A genocide committed through quote-unquote kindness. To my colleagues at Loudon Pharma, I know many of you will be angry with me, now that my actions have set back your work and research by years. But what I ask of you now is to spend that time you have to think about the consequences of what you are doing. Read and listen to the words of Cassandra Bell as I have. I believe in what she has to say. I believe in her. I follow her philosophy in the things I do today. I believe that you might do the same in time. Goodbye, and all the best to Haydens everywhere. I am with you, always.
None of this makes any goddamn sense, Jim Buchhold said. We were in the family room of Buchhold and Wisson's home outside Leesburg. The Leesburg police, Loudon County sheriffs, and FBI apparently had to just about forcibly remove Buchhold from the Loudon Pharma campus in order to get him out of the way so they could do their work. As a result, Buchold was pacing around his family room feeling useless. Wilson had fixed his husband a drink to calm him down. It sat undrunk on the table. Eventually, Wisson helped himself to it.
"Why doesn't it make any goddamn sense?" Van asked.
"Because Carl was a principal investigator for Neuralease."
"Which is?" Van prompted.
"It's the drug we were developing to stimulate the voluntary nervous system in Hayden's victims," Buchold said.
In spite of myself, I felt vaguely annoyed at the use of the word victim in that sentence.
"Hayden suppresses the ability of the brain to speak to the voluntary nervous system. Neuralease encourages the brain to develop new pathways to the system. We've done tests on chips that worked and have been working on genetically modified mice. Progress was slow, but encouraging."
"Is Neuralease the actual chemical?" I asked.
"It's the brand name we're planning to use for it," Buchold said. "The actual name of the chemical compound is about 120 letters long. The most recent iteration of the compound, the one Carl was working on, was called LPNX211 for internal record keeping."
"And Dr. Baer never showed any indication of developing a moral opposition to what he was researching?" Van asked.
"Of course not," Buchold said. "I didn't spend that much time with him, but as far as I know, the only things that Carl actually cared about were his work in Notre Dame football. He went there for undergrad. When he had a presentation, he always managed to put in a slide with the team in it. I tolerated it because his work was that good."
"What was his relationship with Jake Kearney?" I asked.
"Who?"
"The integrator, whose body we think Baer used to drive the vehicle into the parking garage," Van said.
"Never heard of him," Buchold said. "Carl always used his threep at work."
"Did you see Kearney integrating with Baer outside of work?" I asked.
Buchold glanced over at his husband.
"We didn't exactly run in the same social circles," Wisson said. "I don't encourage Jim to be overly friendly with his staff. It's better if they see him as a boss rather than a friend."
"So that would be a no," Van said. "It's not because he's a Hayden."
"Was a Hayden," Buchold said. He turned to me.
"I treat all my employees equally. We have a compliance officer in HR to make sure of it."
"I believe you," I said.
"Yes, but you also heard that son of a bitch Hubbard running me down tonight," Buchold said. "I have 15 Hayden researchers on my staff. None of them would be there if they thought I was treating them as subhuman or what we were doing was bad for Haydens."
"Mr. Buchold," I said, and held up a hand. "I'm not here to judge you. And I'm not here to run back to my father and whisper into his ear about you. Right now I am here investigating the bombing of your facilities. Our primary suspect at the moment is one of your employees. Our only interest is finding out if he's really the bomber and why he did it." Buchold seemed to relax a bit at that. And then Van tensed him all up again.
"Did Dr. Baer ever talk about Cassandra Bell?" she asked.
"Why the hell would he do that?"
"Jim?" Wisson said.
"No," Buchold said, shooting a look at his husband. "I never heard him speak about Cassandra Bell."
"What about the researchers around him?" Van continued.
"There would be casual talk about her because she's on record opposing our line of research," Buchold said. "We always wondered if protesters would show up like they do because of the animal testing we have to do, but none ever did, and I don't think anyone really gave her a whole lot of thought. Why?"
I looked over to Van to see what she thought. She nodded at me.
"Dr. Baer left behind a suicide note," I said. "He mentioned Cassandra Bell in it."
"How?
Is she behind this in some way?" Buchold asked.
"We don't have any reason to believe so," Van said, "but we also have to follow up all the leads."
"I knew this was going to happen," Buchold said.
"What was going to happen?" I asked.
"Violence," Buchold said.
"Rick will tell you. Those dipshits passed Abrams Kettering, and I said to him that sooner or later there was going to be a mess. You don't just take 5 million people sucking on the government teat and punt them into the street and expect them to go without a fight." He looked over at me. "No offense."
"None taken," I said, which wasn't entirely true, but I let it go.
"How far does this set you back?"
"You mean our research?"
"Yes."
"It sets us back by years," Buchold said.
"There's data in the lab that wasn't anywhere else."
"You don't have multiple copies of your data?" Van asked.
"Of course we do," Buchold said. And you can't pull it down off your networks?
You don't understand, Buchholz said. We don't ever put anything genuinely sensitive online. The moment we do that, the hacking begins. We'll put up dummy servers with nothing on them but encrypted pictures of cats, for fuck's sake. And we won't tell anyone we've put them out there.
Within 4 hours, we've got hackers from China and Syria cracking them open. We'd be idiots to put actual confidential data into an outside accessible server.
So, all your data was stored locally, I said.
Stored locally, Buchholz said. Stored multiply on internal servers.
What about the archives? Van asked.
Data stored off network.
We did that, of course, and stored it in a secure room on campus.
So, all of it, local and archive data, went up at the lab building.
Van glanced over to me with an expression which I suspect meant these people were sloppy.
Right, Buchholz said. It's possible we can piece together some recent data from emails and the computers in the office building. If they weren't destroyed by either the blast or the fire suppression system. But realistically speaking, years of research. Gone. Dead. Destroyed.
Oh, look, it's midnight, I said to Van as she drove me home. My first real day on the job is over.
Van smiled at this, the cigarette in her mouth bouncing as she did so.
I'm not going to lie to you, she said. It's been a little more hectic than most first days.
I can hardly wait for tomorrow, I said.
I doubt that. Van drooled smoke out of her lips.
You know that shit's going to kill you, right? I asked.
The smoking. There's a reason why no one does it anymore.
There's a reason why I do it, she said.
Yeah? What is it?
Let's say we keep some mystery in our relationship, Van said.
Whatever, I said, with what I hoped was just the right amount of casual flip.
Van smiled again.
Score one for me.
My phone went off. It was Tony.
Shit, I said.
What?
I was supposed to meet with my maybe new roommates tonight, I said.
Do you want me to write you a note? Van asked.
Cute, I said.
Hold on.
I opened the channel and spoke with my inside voice. Hey, Tony.
So, we were all hoping that you might pop by tonight, Tony said.
Yeah, about that, I began. But then I saw that Loudoun Pharma exploded, and they think it might be a terrorist plot or something, and I thought to myself, I'm guessing Chris might be a little busy this evening.
Thank you for understanding, I said.
Looks like you had an exciting day.
You have no idea.
Well, then let me end it with a bit of good news, Tony said. The group tried you in absentia and found you guilty of being a probably worthy flatmate. You're hereby sentenced to the nicest room in the brownstone. May God have mercy on your soul.
That's great, Tony, I said.
No, really, I appreciate it.
That's good to hear. And the rest of us appreciate you paying rent so that we're not thrown out in the street, so we're even.
I'm sending your house code now. Once you're here, change it so no one but you knows it. I got your first and last security deposit, so you're good to go. Show up anytime.
Probably tomorrow, I said. I'm already close to my parents' place. I'm going to crash here for the night.
Sounds good, Tony said.
Now, get some rest. You sound beat.
Good night.
Night, I said. And then switched back to my outside voice.
I got the apartment.
That's nice, Van said.
It's actually a room in an intentional community, I said.
Funny. You don't look like a hippie.
I'll work on it, I promised.
Please don't, she said.
Chapter 9. The next morning, every road in D.C. was jammed from 5:30 a.m. onward. More than 100 Hayden long-range truckers got onto the interstate loop around the city and arranged their trucks in geometrical patterns designed to induce maximum disruption to automatic driving systems and drove at 25 miles an hour. Commuters, frustrated with the loop being more locked up than usual, switched over to manual and tried to get around the blockages, which of course only made things worse. By 7 o'clock, the loop was at a complete standstill. And then, for extra added fun, Hayden truckers locked up Interstate 66 and the toll road into Virginia.
Late on your third day of your job, Van said to me from her desk as I got into the office.
She pointed to the desk next to hers as she did it, indicating that it was my desk now.
Everyone's late today, I said. I should be graded on that curve. How did you manage to get in from Potomac Falls anyway? Van asked. Tell me you borrowed your dad's helicopter. That would be kind of amazing.
As it happens, Dad does have a helicopter, I said, or his company does. But it's not allowed to land in our neighborhood. So, no, I got dropped off at the Sterling stop of the metro and took the train in.
And how was that?
Unpleasant, I said. It was super crowded and I got a lot of nasty looks. Like, it was my fault the roads were crushed. I almost said, look, people, if it were my fault, I wouldn't be on the goddamn train with the rest of you now, would I?
It's going to be a long week with this shit, Van said.
It's not an effective protest if it's not pissing people off.
I didn't say it wasn't effective, Van said. I didn't even say I wasn't sympathetic. It just means it's going to be a long week.
Now, come on. Forensics has got news for us.
What news? I asked.
On our dead guy, Van said. We know who he is, and apparently there's something else, too.
First off, Ramon Diaz said, meet John Sonny, your no longer mystery man. We were back in the imaging suite, looking at a highly detailed, larger-than-life image of Sonny on the morgue slab. It was cleaner and less annoying to the medical examiners to have field agents look at their handiwork this way. The model Diaz was projecting could be manipulated to examine any part of the body that the examiners scanned or opened. At this point, the body did not look as if it had been cut into any more than it already had been at the neck. This was the cover scan.
So the Navajo came through for us, Van said.
They did, Diaz said. Looks like they sent his information to us around midnight their time last night.
Who is he? I asked.
As far as the information we have tells us, he's not anyone, Diaz said. The Navajo Nation have him on file for a single drunken disorderly when he was 19. No time, community service. Other than that, what we've got is his birth certificate and social security, a few medical records, and his high school transcripts, which run through 10th grade.
How'd he do? Van asked.
The fact it stops at the 10th grade might tell you something.
No driver's license or other sort of ID? I asked.
No, Diaz said.
What else? Van asked.
He's 31 and was in less than great health, Diaz said. Some liver damage and heart disease and signs of incipient diabetes, which is not too surprising in someone with a Native American background. Missing a few teeth in the back. Also, that slash in his neck is consistent with a self-inflicted wound. He did it to himself, and he did it with that broken glass you found.
Is this everything? I asked.
Diaz smiled. No, it's not.
I have something for you that I think you're going to find really interesting.
Cut the suspense, Diaz, Van said. Get to it.
They did an x-ray of his skull before they took out his brain, Diaz said. He popped up the three-dimensional scan on Sonny's head.
Tell me what you see.
Holy shit, I said immediately.
Huh, Van said after a second.
The x-ray of Sonny's head showed a network of thin tendrils and coils in and around the brain, converging on five junctions distributed radially around the interior surface of the skull, the junctions themselves linked to each other in a mesh of connections. It was an artificial neural network designed to send and receive information from the brain, displayed in almost perfect detail. Two groups of people had structures like these. I belonged to one of those groups. Van belonged to the other.
This dude's an integrator, I said.
What's his brain structure? Van asked Diaz.
The report says it's consistent with someone who contracted Hayden's, Diaz said. And that's consistent with his medical records, which show he had meningitis as a kid, which could mean the Hayden's variety. He's got the brain structure to be an integrator.
Shane, Van said, still looking at the x-ray.
Yeah, I said.
Problems with this scenario, Van said.
I thought about it for a minute.
This guy didn't get through high school, I said, finally.
So? Van said.
So, integrator training is a postgraduate thing, I said. You undertake it after getting a suitable undergraduate degree like psychology. What's yours?
Biology, Van said. American University.
Right, I said. Plus, there's supposed to be a raft of psychological and aptitude tests you have to clear before they let you into the program. It's one of the reasons there's so few integrators.
Yes, Van said. It's expensive, too, the training process.
Not for the student, Van said. The NIH covers the costs.
They must have been pissed at you when you left, I said.
They got their money's worth from me, Van said. Bring it back around.
Okay,
So the question here is, here is a guy who didn't finish high school and who we have no record of anywhere outside of the Navajo Nation, which means he didn't have integrator training. I pointed to the X-ray. So how does this guy get all that wiring in his head? That's a good question, Van said. It's not the only question. What else is wrong about this picture? What isn't wrong about this picture? I asked. I meant specifically. Why would an integrator want to integrate with another integrator? I asked. More specific than that. I don't know how to get more specific than that, I said. Why would an integrator want to integrate with another integrator and bring a headset? Van asked. I looked at her blankly for a couple of seconds. Then, oh shit, the headset. Right, Van said. That reminds me, Diaz said to me. I got inside that headset like you asked to see if there was any useful information on those processor chips. Was there? I asked. No, Diaz said. There were no chips inside the headset. If there are no chips inside, then it wouldn't work. It's a dummy headset, I said. That would be my thinking, yes, Diaz said. I turned to Van. Seriously, what the hell is going on here? I said. What do you mean? Van asked. I mean, what the hell is going on here? We've got two integrators, one of whom shouldn't be an integrator, and a dummy headset. It doesn't make any sense. Van turned to Diaz. Fingerprints on the headset? Yes, he said. They match Sonny, not Bell. So Sonny brought the headset to the party, not Bell, Van said, then looked back at me. What does that suggest to you? Maybe that Bell didn't know Sonny was an integrator, I said, and that Sonny didn't want him to know he was one either. Right, Van said. Okay, but again, why? I asked. What possible use is there for Sonny to convince Bell that he's just a tourist? Without the headset, he can't even be that. Unless there's some integrator-to-integrator ability I don't know about. No, Van said. There's a sort of neural feedback loop that happens when you try to put one integrator into the head of another. You can fry people's brains that way. Like scanners? I asked. Like what? An old movie about psychics. They could make your head blow up. Van smiled. Nothing that outwardly dramatic. But inwardly, it's not supposed to be pleasant. It's blocked at the network level in any event. So it couldn't have been that, I said. Plus the whole suicide thing again. Van was quiet again. Then, what time is it in Arizona? It's 2 hours behind here, so about 8:30, I said. Maybe? Arizona's weird about time zones. You need to go out there today and talk to some people, Van said. Me? Yes, you, Van said. You can get there in 10 seconds for nothing. There's the small fact I will have no body, I said. You're not the only Hayden on the FBI staff, Van said. The Bureau keeps spare threeps at the major field offices. Phoenix will have them for you. It won't be fancy, she motioned to my threep, but it will get the job done. Are the Navajo going to cooperate with us? I asked. If we let them know we're trying to figure out the death of one of their own, they might come around, Van said. I have a friend in the Phoenix office. Let's see if he can make things easier. Let's get you out there by 10 their time. I can't just call, I asked. You need to tell some family their son or dad is dead and then ask them a bunch of personal questions, Van said. Yeah, no, you can't just call. It'll be my first trip to Arizona, I said. Hope you like hot, Van said. At 10:05, I found myself in the Phoenix FBI field office looking at a bald man. Agent Beresford? I asked. Damn, that's creepy, the man said. This threep's been in the corner for 3 years without moving, and suddenly it gets up. It's like a statue coming to life. Surprise, I said. I mean, we've been using it as a hat rack. Sorry to deprive you of your office furniture. It's only for the day. You Shane? That's right. Tom Beresford. He held out his hand. I took it. I don't mind telling you, I've never forgiven your dad for crushing the Suns in 4. Oh, that, I said. He was talking about Dad's second NBA title. If it means anything, he always said that series was closer than it looked. It's nice of him to lie like that, Beresford said. Come on, I'll take you down to meet Claw. I started walking and stopped. Jesus, I said, and started jerking my leg.
Something wrong? Beresford stopped and waited on me. You weren't kidding when you said this thing didn't move, I said. I think something's rusted up in this thing. I can get you a can of WD-40 if you want. Nice, I said. Just give me a second. I fired up the Threak's diagnostic system to find out what was going on. Great, it's a Metro Courier. Is that a problem? Beresford asked. The Metro Courier is like the Ford Pinto of Threeps. We could try to find you a rental Threep if you want, Beresford said. I think Enterprise might have some at the airport. It'll just take forever, and you'll spend your day filling out requisition forms. It'll be fine, I said. The diagnostic said there was nothing wrong with the Threep, which may have meant there was something wrong with the diagnostic. I'll walk it out. Come on, then. Beresford started off again. I followed, limping. Agent Chris Shane, Officer Claw Redhouse, Beresford said after we reached the lobby, introducing me to a young man in a uniform. Claw went to Northern Arizona with my son. As it happens, he was in Phoenix on tribal business, so you got lucky. It would be a 285-mile walk to Window Rock otherwise. Officer Redhouse, I said, and held out my hand. He took it and smiled. Don't meet a lot of Haydens, he said. Never met one who was an FBI agent before. A first time for everything, I said. You're limping, he said. Childhood injury, I said. And then, after a second, that was a joke. I got that, he said. Come on, I'm parked right outside. I'll be right there, I said, and then turned to Beresford. There's a possibility that I might need this Threep for a while. It's just collecting dust with us, Beresford said. So it won't be a problem if I keep it in Window Rock for a while, I asked. That's going to be up to the folks up there, Beresford said. Our official policy is to defer to their sovereignty, so if they want you away when you're done, head to our office in Flagstaff. I'll let them know you might be on the way. Or get a hotel room. Maybe someone will rent you a broom closet and a plug. Is this a problem? I asked. I'm not really versed in the relations between the FBI and the Navajo. We don't have any problems at the moment, Beresford said. We've cooperated with them just fine recently, and they have Claw taking you up, which says they don't have a problem with you. But other than that, who knows? The U.S. government gave the Navajo and a lot of the other Native American nations a whole lot more autonomy a couple of decades back when it downsized the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service. But that's also given us an excuse to ignore them and their problems. Ah, I said. Hell, Shane, you might be able to sympathize, Beresford said. The U.S. government just pulled the plug on the Haydens, didn't it? It's something you folks might say you have in common with the Navajo. I'm not entirely sure I want to be going around making that comparison, I said. That's probably wise, Beresford said. The Navajo have a 200-year head start in the getting screwed by the U.S. government category. They might not appreciate you jumping on the train. But now you might understand why some of them might decide to be touchy about you showing up and asking questions. So be polite, be respectful, and go if they tell you to go. Got it. Good, Beresford said. Now go on. Claw's good people. Don't keep them waiting.
Chapter 10 The ride up to Window Rock took 4.5 hours, with Redhouse and me passing the time in innocuous conversation, followed by long lapses of silence. Redhouse seemed to enjoy my stories about getting to travel the world with my father, and noted that his own travels had been far less extensive. I've been in the 4 states the Navajo Nation sits in, he said, and the most time that I spent away from it was when I went to Flagstaff for college. Other than that, been nowhere but here. Have you wanted to go anywhere else? I asked. Sure, he said. When you're a kid, all you want to do is be somewhere else. Pretty sure that's a universal thing, I said. I know, Redhouse said, and smiled. And now I don't mind it so much. I like my family better now that I'm older. Have a fiancé, have a job. Did you always want to be a police officer? I asked. No, he said, and smiled again. I went to college for computer science. That's kind of a left turn, I said. Just before I went to college, the council decided to invest in a huge server facility outside Window Rock, Redhouse said. It would serve the needs of the Navajo and other nations, and then also be used by the surrounding state governments and even the federal government for non-confidential processing and storage, solar-powered and zero-emission.
It was going to employ hundreds of Navajo and bring millions of dollars into Window Rock. So when I went to college, I studied computing so that I could have a job. The Flagstaff news site even did a story about me and some of my classmates in northern Arizona. They called us the Silicon Navajos, which I didn't like very much. So what happened? We built the facility, and then none of the promised state or federal contracts came in, Red House said. We were told about budget cuts and reorganizations and changes in agendas and new governors and presidents coming in. We have this state-of-the-art facility now, and it's operating at 3% of capacity. Not so many people got hired to staff it at 3%. So I went to the police academy and became a police officer. Sorry about the switch, I said. It's not so bad, Red House said. I had family who were officers before me, so you could say it was a tradition. And I'm doing some good, so that helps. But if I'd known my degree was going to be useless, I might not have scheduled so many 8 a.m. classes. Did you always want to be an FBI agent? I wanted to be one of those CSI agents, I said. Problem for that was my degree is in English. Oof, Red House said. We'll see the computer facility as we drive in. You can get a look at what wasted potential looks like. An hour later, just south of Window Rock, we rolled by a large, featureless building surrounded on three sides by solar panels. I'm guessing that's it, I said. That's it, Red House said. The one positive thing about it is that since we don't need all the solar capacity we installed, we sell energy to Arizona and New Mexico. At least you'll make a profit somehow. I wouldn't call it a profit, Red House said. It just means running the computer facility bleeds us more slowly than it would otherwise. My mother worked for the council. She says that they're going to give it a couple more years, tops. What will they do with the building? I asked. That is the question, isn't it, Agent Shane? Red House said. He sat up, pressed a button on his dash, and took over manual control of the police car. Now, let's get you checked in at the station, and then we can take you to go see Johnny Sonny's family. My captain is probably going to want to have an officer accompany you. Is that going to be a problem? I don't think so. Okay, good, Red House said. Is it going to be you? I asked. Red House smiled once more. Probably. Sonny's family lived in a well-kept double-wide in an otherwise less-than-spiff trailer park outside of Sawmill. The family consisted of a grandmother and a sister. Both sat on a couch, looking at me, numbly.
Why would he kill himself? His sister, Janice, asked me.
I don't know, I said. I was hoping you might be able to tell me.
How did he do it?
Asked the grandmother, May.
Shimasani, you don't want to know that, Janice said.
Yes, I do, May said, forcefully. I looked over to Red House, who was standing next to the chair I was sitting in, holding the glass of tea they offered him. They offered me one as well. It sat on the table in front of me, between me and Sonny's relatives. Red House nodded at me.
He cut his throat, I said.
May looked at me balefully but said nothing else. Janice held her grandmother and looked at me expressionless. I waited for a couple of minutes and then began again. Our records show, I said, and then stopped. Well, actually, we don't have any records for John.
Johnny, Janice said.
Excuse me, I said. Johnny. All the records we have for Johnny are from here, from the Navajo Nation. So our first question is why that's the case.
Until last year, Johnny never left here, Janice said.
All right, I said. But why is that?
Johnny was slow, Janice said. We had a doctor test him when he was 13. He said his IQ was 79 or 80. Johnny could figure things out if he worked at it, but it took him a long time. We kept him in school as long as we could so he could have friends, but he couldn't keep up. He stopped going, and we stopped making him go. He wasn't always that way, May said. He was a smart baby, a smart little boy. When he was 5, he got sick. He wasn't the same after that.
Was it Hayden's? I asked.
No, May said. He wasn't crippled.
She stopped and considered what she had said.
Sorry.
I held a hand up. It's perfectly all right, I said. Sometimes people get sick with Hayden's, but they don't get locked in. But it can still do damage.
When you say he got sick, did he have a fever? And then meningitis?
His brain swelled up, May said. That's meningitis, I said.
We scanned his brain after he died, and we saw the brain structure there that was consistent with Hayden's. But we found something else, too. We found that he had something we call a neural network in there, too.
Janice looked up at Red House for this.
It's like a machine in his head, Janice, he said. It let him send and receive information.
I have one in my head back home, I said, and tapped my head. It lets me control this machine here so I can be here in the room with you.
Janice and May both looked confused.
Johnny didn't have anything in his head, May said, finally.
I apologize for asking, but...
Are you completely sure? I asked.
A neural network isn't something that's accidentally put into someone's head. It's there to either send brain signals or to receive them.
He lived with me his entire life, May said. He lived here with his mother and Janice, and then when his mother died, I looked after him. No way this could happen to him here.
So it would have to have been put in after he left, Red House said.
About that, I said.
Why would Johnny decide to leave here if he'd never gone anywhere in his life?
He got a job, Janice said.
What kind of job? I asked.
He said he was an executive assistant, Janice said.
For whom?
I don't know, Janice said.
Johnny got a friend to take him down to that computer building in Window Rock, May said. He'd heard they had an opening for a janitor, then that was something he could do. He wanted to be able to help me out. He went down and asked about the job, and then the next day they asked him to come down again. And then, when he came back that night, he gave me $1,000 and told me it was half of his first paycheck from his new job.
The janitorial position, Red House said.
No, the other one, May said. He said when they got there, they asked him if he would like a different job that would pay better and let him travel. All he'd have to do is help his boss do things. He said it was like being a butler.
So he left, I said.
What then? Every week I'd get a money order from Johnny, and he would call sometimes, May said. He told me to move someplace nice and get new things. So I moved here. Then, a few months ago, he stopped calling, but the money order still arrived, so I didn't worry too much.
When did the last money order arrive?
It came 2 days ago, Janice said. I picked up my grandmother's mail for her.
Do you mind if I look at it? I asked.
They both looked dubious at this. Aiden Shane isn't going to take it as evidence, Red House said, but it might have something on it that's important. Janice got up to get the money order.
Johnny never said anything about who he worked for? I asked May.
He said that his boss liked to be private, May said. I didn't want Johnny to lose his job, so I never asked more than that.
Did he like his job? I asked.
By this time, Janice had walked over to me with the money order. I scanned it quickly on one side, flipped it over and did the same to the other side, then handed it back to her.
Thank you, I said.
He seemed to like it, May said. He never said anything bad about it.
He was excited to travel, Janice said, sitting down again. The first couple of times he called, he mentioned that he was in California and in Washington.
The state or the district? Red House asked.
The district, Janice said, I think. But then he said his boss didn't like him talking about where he'd been, so he didn't say any more.
The last time he called, did he say anything unusual or tell you anything unusual? I asked.
No, May said. He said he hadn't been feeling well. No. He said he was worried about something.
Worried about what? I asked.
A test? May ventured. Something that he had to do that he was nervous about? I don't remember.
Okay, I said.
When do we get him back? Janice asked. I mean, when does he get to come home?
I don't know, I said. I can check.
He needs to be buried here, May said. I'll see what I can do, I said. That's a promise.
May and Janice looked at me, expressionlessly.
They handled it well, I said, after Red House and I left the trailer and headed to the car.
Some of us try not to show too much emotion about death, Red House said. The thinking is, if you go on about it, you can keep a spirit from moving on.
Do you believe that? I asked.
It doesn't matter whether I believe it or not, Red House said.
Fair point, I said.
Anything on the money order?
Serial number and routing information, I said. You want it?
I wouldn't mind, Red House said.
I don't know if the FBI would be happy with you for sharing information.
I think my partner would tell me that sharing with the local police is the polite thing to do, unless you hate that cop in particular.
You have an interesting partner.
That I do, I said, and got into the car.
Let's go down to the server farm.
Johnny Sonny, Lauren Begay said. He was the head of HR for the Window Rock Computational Facility, as well as the head of several other departments, including sales and janitorial. The staff at WRCF was as bare bones as Red House had advertised. I went to school with him for a while.
I'm asking about something a little closer in time than that, I said. His family said he applied for a job here last year. Is that right?
He did, Begay said. Had to fire a janitor for sleeping on the job. Needed someone who could take the overnight shift. He applied. So did 60 other people. I gave it to one of the other janitor's sister.
Johnny Sonny's family said that you called him back for a follow-up, and that's when he got offered a different job, Red House said.
I never called him back, Begay said.
You didn't? I asked.
Why would I call him back? Begay asked.
The man's slow as they come. He could barely fill out the application.
You don't need much of an education to push a broom, Red House said.
No, but I want someone with enough sense not to touch any buttons he's not supposed to, Begay said. This place isn't to capacity, but we still have clients.
Who are your clients, Mr. Begay? I asked.
Begay looked over to Red House.
It's okay, Red House said.
Begay looked unconvinced about the okayness, but spoke anyway. All of the nation's governmental departments are in here, plus a few others from nations around the country. Then we've got a few private clients, mostly businesses from around here or that do business around here. The biggest of those would be Medicord.
What's Medicord? I asked.
Medical Services Company, Begay said. They contract to run the nation's medical services. Been doing that for 6-7 years.
I remember when they came in, Red House said. Promised to train and promote Navajo medical personnel in return for an exclusive contract.
Have they? I asked.
Red House shrugged.
It's quasi-governmental and confidential medical information, so Medicord keeps all the Navajo data here instead of linking it up with the rest of their network, Begay said.
No one else would use this facility to do a job search? I asked.
I wish they would, Begay said. We've got the office space and we could use the business, but no.
Do any of the private companies send reps or IT guys here?
The companies we got, if they had an IT department, they probably wouldn't need us so much, Begay said. But they don't need to come here anyway. They can access their servers and data remotely with standard software. What we do is host and act as backup if, for some reason, what IT people they have do something stupid, which does happen.
Can someone hack into this place? I asked.
I should tell you no, but you're a Hayden, so I'm guessing you're not stupid about these things, Begay said. So I'll tell you that if anything is connected to the outside world, it's hackable. That said, all the nation data is on servers that are accessible only from nation computers that are either GPS tagged or require two-factor authentication or both.
And that includes this Medicord company, I said.
It does, said Begay.
Why are you asking about Johnny Sonny?
He died, I said.
It's too bad, Begay said. He was a nice guy.
I thought you said he was slow.
He was slow, Begay said. Doesn't mean he wasn't nice.
This keeps getting more fucked up as we go along, doesn't it? Van asked me.
It was 7:30 in D.C., and from the ambient sound around her, I could tell she was in a bar again, possibly picking up from last night on her quest to get laid. I was in the Window Rock Police Department at a spare desk using my inside voice.
We have two choices at this point, I said.
We have to believe that either a guy who couldn't get a job pushing a mop is also a savant integrator who somehow lured Nicholas Bell into that hotel room on the pretense that he was a tourist looking for a thrill, or we have to believe